Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Let's now go to the speech by Nick Hanauer that Ted tried to suppress.
It is astounding how significantly one idea can shape a society and its policies. Consider this one. If taxes on the rich go up, job creation will go down. This idea is an article of faith for Republicans and seldom challenged by Democrats and has indeed shaped much of the economic landscape. But sometimes the ideas that we are certain are true are dead wrong. Consider that for thousands of years, humans believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. It's not, and an astronomer who still believed that it was would do some pretty terrible astronomy. Likewise, a policymaker who believes that the rich are job creators and therefore should not be taxed will do equally terrible policy. I have started or helped start dozens of companies and initially hired lots of people. But if there was no one around who could afford to buy what we had to sell, all those companies and all those jobs would have evaporated. That's why I can say with confidence that rich people don't create jobs, nor do businesses large or small. Jobs are a consequence of a circle of life-like feedback loop between customers and businesses. And only consumers can set in motion this virtuous cycle of increasing demand and hiring. In this sense, an ordinary consumer is more of a job creator than a capitalist like me. That's why when business people take credit for creating jobs, it's a little bit like squirrels taking credit for creating evolution. It's actually the other way around. Anyone who's ever run a business knows that hiring more people is a course of last resort for capitalists. It's what we do if and only if rising consumer demand requires it. And in this sense, calling ourselves job creators isn't just inaccurate, it's disingenuous. That's why our existing policies are so upside down. When the biggest tax exemptions and the lowest tax rates benefit the richest, all in the name of job creation, all that happens is that the rich get richer. Since 1980, the share of income for the top 1% of Americans has more than tripled, while our effective tax rates have gone down by 50%. If it was true that lower taxes for the rich and more wealth for the wealthy led to job creation, today we would be drowning in jobs. And thank you. And yet, unemployment and underemployment is at record highs. Another reason that this idea is so wrong-headed is that there can never be enough super-rich people to power a great economy. Somebody like me makes hundreds or thousands of times as much as the median American, but I don't buy hundreds or thousands of times as much stuff. My family owns 3 cars, not 3,000. I buy a few pairs of pants and shirts a year like most American men. Occasionally, we go out to eat with friends. I can't buy enough of anything to make for the fact that millions of unemployed and underemployed Americans can't buy any new cars, any clothes, or enjoy any meals out. Nor can I make up for the falling consumption of the vast majority of middle-class families that are barely squeaking by, buried by spiraling costs and trapped by stagnant or declining wages. Here's an incredible fact, that if the typical American family still retained the same share of income that they did in 1970, they'd earn like $45,000 more a year. Imagine what our economy would be like if that were the case. Significant privileges have come to people like me, capitalists, for being perceived as job creators at the center of the economic universe, and the language and metaphors we use to defend the current economic and social arrangements is telling. It's a small jump from job creator to the creator. This language obviously wasn't This language was not chosen by accident. And it's only honest to admit that when somebody like me calls themselves a job creator, we're not just describing how the economy works, but more particularly, we're making a claim on status and privileges that we deserve. Speaking of special privileges, the extraordinary differential between the 15% tax rate that capitalists pay on carried interest, dividends, and capital gains And the 35% top marginal rate on work that ordinary Americans pay is kind of hard to justify without a touch of deification. We've had it backwards for the last 30 years. Rich people like me don't create jobs. Jobs are a consequence of an ecosystemic feedback loop between customers and businesses. And when the middle class thrives, businesses grow and hire, and owners profit. That's why taxing the rich to pay for investments that benefit all is such a fantastic deal for the middle class and the rich. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's an idea worth spreading. In a capitalist economy, the true job creators are middle-class consumers. And taxing the rich to make investments that make the middle class grow and thrive is the single shrewdest thing we can do for the middle class, for the poor, and for the rich. Thank you.
And joining us now is Nicholas Hanau, who's a Seattle-based serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, author, and activist with a knack for identifying and building transformative business models. In 1995, he became the first non-family investor in Amazon.com, where he served as a board advisor until January of 2000. During the same time period, he founded and served as CEO of A Quantitative Inc., and a short time later founded Gear.com. A Quantitative was acquired by Microsoft for $6.4 billion, the largest acquisition in Microsoft's history, and Gear.com merged with Overstock.com in 2001. His latest book is The Gardens of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Hanau.
Thank you.
And you gave a speech to TED, which unfortunately the universe was denied until recently, when I take it that TED was sort of guilted into releasing the video of your talk, which they've done in all, more or less for all of their previous talks. What was so controversial about the talk that TED felt that they had to hold it back?
Yeah, well, in defense of TED and Chris Anderson, they don't release every talk. They release many talks, and they didn't want to release mine. They were going to release it, and then at the last minute decided that they would prefer not to because it is controversial. And look, it's Chris's conference. He's entitled to do whatever he wants. Because it is controversial, because the subject and the argument is an attack on an economic orthodoxy that lots and lots of people have a big stake in, upset some people. But, you know, as soon as, to their credit, they quickly released it, and it's available to anyone on the internet to watch now. So.
Well, that's true, but I thought we lived in a democracy. I thought, free speech was the currency of democracy. And just because we're in an election year, we should have more speech, not less, surely.
I would agree with you, but it's not Chris's obligation to release every speech. And sure. I struggle with flagging Ted and Chris, who I respect a lot. We had a disagreement, and they at first didn't want to take the blowback they would inevitably get from releasing a talk as argumentative as mine, and I understand that. And look, it is argumentative, and it definitely antagonizes rich people, and there are many rich people associated with TED conferences.
So, sure, but there's also a thing called the 99% versus the 1%, which has definitely joined and become a part of late of the political zeitgeist. And
it is.
Undoubtedly, the 99 of the 1% have plenty of them a megaphone. In fact, some people have argued recently that the real divide in terms of the money that's going into the elections, the 2012 elections, to determine the political leadership of this country is being dominated by the 0.00063%, with a handful of billionaires pouring money into super PACs. So,
and that is absolutely correct. Both our economy and our political structures are increasingly being dominated by a very, very tiny minority of people. And I think the reason that my argument is getting so much play is that it's an attack, and a reasonably persuasive attack, on that approach. You know, we live in a culture that has deified capitalists and wealthy people, and we have built, an economic orthodoxy, a way of understanding how the world works, that places a tiny number of very rich people essentially at the center of the economic universe. We even call ourselves job creators. The language isn't chosen by accident. It's a tiny leap from job creator to the creator. And the awesome thing about being at the center of the economic universe, of course, is that you both get to deserve and claim status and privileges, which is how people like me, capitalists like me, end up paying taxes at a rate which is vastly lower than the rate that ordinary Americans pay, right? There's a 233% difference between the 15% tax I pay on capital gains, dividends, and carried interest, and the 35% top marginal rate ordinary Americans pay on work. And so, this idea, which is very central to the idea of how the world works from an economic perspective, and is broadly accepted by both Democrats and Republicans, is essentially shapes the economic and political landscape. And of course, if it's not true, if capitalists aren't job creators, middle class consumers and the demand they represent are job creators, then you are necessarily going to end up with a very different political and economic landscape.
Well, surely, but that's what's been happening, hasn't it? That the landscape has changed, and I don't think you have to go back as far as the robber barons, Nick Hanau, to see that we used to our capitalism used to be predicated upon producing products, creating wealth, and employing people. And now, with the growing financialization of the economy, much of the model is about an extraction and concentration model, extracting wealth and concentrating it at the top.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're roughly correct. I mean, capitalism comes in as many flavors as pie. You can have dirt pie, which tastes terrible, or cherry pie, which tastes delicious. And, there are flavors of capitalism that both produce great opportunity and wealth for every citizen, and there are flavors of capitalism that concentrate wealth at the very tippy top and end up excluding most people. And I think that we are veering dangerously towards the latter these days. I think we have over-financialized our markets. I think that we have allowed the wealth and power to accumulate at the tippy top in very unhealthy ways. And what's remarkable about that is how willing most citizens have been to go along with it. And I would posit that the reason they've been so willing is that they have accepted this economic orthodoxy, that rich business people are job creators, and that if we pour more money into them, essentially like in the form of tax breaks, like an ingredient, prosperity will squirt out of them like donuts. And of course, that is not true. And that trickle-down thesis makes sense if you accept a 19th century view of how human social systems like economies work. But as we argue in our book, The Gardens of Democracy, if you understand human social systems like economies ecosystemically and in terms of how they actually are, then those, the trickle-down thesis just instantly becomes obviously nonsense.
Well, of course, Nick Hanau, if as you say, people have, and I'm not quoting you, but if people have drunk the Kool-Aid and that they believe that the rich job creators are their salvation, then they're going to vote for Mitt Romney, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, so Mitt Romney, I think, genuinely thinks of himself as a job creator. He genuinely thinks that prosperity trickles down from the tippy top, and he genuinely believes, I believe, that the lower tax rate is applied to him, the better off the country will be. It's just, the problem is, it's just categorically untrue. If there was a shred of truth to the argument or the idea that the more wealth the wealthy had, or the lower their taxes were, the more jobs we would create, then today we would be drowning in jobs. And yet, today we have unemployment and underemployment at 50-year highs. There's another similar idea, which is the less taxes corporations pay and the more profitable they are, the more jobs and prosperity we'll have generally. This is also not true. Corporate profits are at a 40-year high. Unemployment and underemployment is at a 50-year high. And that's because corporations don't hire people when they have an abundance of profit. They hire people when they have an abundance of customers. And because the economic and social policies we put in place over the last 30 years have so radically undermined the middle class and the working class, we're in a death spiral of falling demand. So, it's charming for about a minute to be at the very tippy top and be creating all this wealth or grabbing all this wealth. But ultimately, capitalists like me need customers. And if those customers don't have money, sooner or later, we're going to be all out of business.
Let's take a brief station break, after which we'll return to the conversation with Nick Hanauer.
You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. So Nick Hanauer, again, Seattle-based serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, author, and activist. He was the first non-family investor in Amazon.com, and his latest book is The Gardens of Democracy. Why are the Democrats and Obama not making this argument then? I mean, one of the things that I've been astounded by was that after the 2008 crash, when Obama first came in, he put a lot of political capital, obviously, into the stimulus, and then went off and put an awful lot of capital, both he and Pelosi, into cap and trade that didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of ever succeeding. And meanwhile, the political right in this country, in the form of the Tea Party, ran away with the outrage against the bailouts on Wall Street and the general notion that Wall Street took the global economy to the brink of collapse and that the overburdened taxpayer had to rescue them. Why did they leave that on the table for the right to grab? And why aren't they coming up with your narrative? Because, you've got the truth on you.
Honestly, I think because they don't understand. And they don't understand for a very good reason, and that is that these ideas, which are extraordinarily obvious and intuitive when you hear them for the first time, are actually very new, because the science of understanding these systems as complex, adaptive, and ecosystemic is brand new. That we now know with scientific certainty that the economy isn't just similar to an ecosystem. It actually literally is a kind of ecosystem. But that awareness is literally only a decade or two old at most. And because sciences are currently being revolutionized by the study of complex adaptive systems and chaos theory and stuff like that. So this stuff has not seeped into the popular culture yet, and is certainly nowhere in most economics textbooks. They're tiny enclaves. For instance, there's the Institute for New Economic Thinking at Oxford University in England, and a couple of other outposts. But this way of understanding things is unorthodox, to say the least, and it will take a while for it to seep in. And so, they're just not there yet, although I wish they were.
So short of Obama reading your book, The Gardens of Democracy, the evidence is manifest, Nick Hanauer, that austerity is not working. It's certainly not working in Europe. And in fact, you can argue that Obama's political fate is in the hands of Merkel. And if they can kick the can down until after November, he'll probably get reelected. But if they can't, then Romney might. And so there's a lot at stake for Obama, clearly. But we also know that in fundamental terms, there is something wrong with the disparity of wealth and the growing disparity of wealth and the downsizing of the middle class, because it's not just the economic reality that the middle class are the bulwark of America. It's also our mythology. That's where the American dream is reposed.
Right. And, you know, the middle class is both an economic is both economically necessary, but it's also, I mean, to be clear, politically necessary, because if it disappears, there will be revolution. So in 1980, the top 1% of Americans had 8% share of, plus or minus 8.5% share of national income, and the bottom 50% of Americans shared about 18% of national income. Today, the top 1% get about 24% of national income, and the bottom 50% share about 12% of national income. In another 30 years, if the trend does not change, the top 1% of Americans will have about 37% of national income, and the bottom 50% of Americans will share just 6% of national income. That is a situation which is essentially, it's untenable. And not only does it represent a death spiral of falling demand for a capitalist economy, but it represents, essentially political, revolution. So it's a very serious problem. But, you know, look, if you want the economy to grow, you want the median wage to rise. Because when the average family has more money to spend, they buy more stuff. And when they buy more stuff, capitalists both hire and thrive. And that's the feedback loop we need to create, basically a circle of life-like feedback loop between customers and businesses. And in that sense, austerity is a disaster. Now, that being said, irresponsibility is also a disaster. And governments around the world have been terrifically irresponsible in the way that they have organized themselves. And certainly in this country, we have to get things like Medicaid and Medicare spending under control. We have to get our military spending under control, and we have to rationalize Social Security in a way that makes it stable for the long term. But slashing these programs in the near term is a catastrophe economically, particularly when there's so much money available from rich people and corporations. That could be reinvested in the society, essentially economically costlessly.
Well,
if I could just add, one of the pervasive ideas is that if you tax rich people more, the economy will slow down, or if you tax corporations more, the economy will slow down. And an ecosystemic view leads you to the conclusion that is not true, certainly not to a large degree. One of the ways in which we misunderstand how this stuff works is that we think of what government does as spending, right? And that's what government does. It spends our money. But the word spending and the metaphors that it represents actually means to extinguish value, like a spent match or spent ammunition. It's like when we send taxes to the government, when they spend it, it's like they swept it in the piles and burned it. But of course, a complex adaptive system is like a giant circulation system. That those tax dollars aren't destroyed; they're circulated. And so, when government taxes the rich and reinvests in the middle class, the economy doesn't slow down; it speeds up. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, money is the lifeblood of an economy. The more it circulates, the healthier the economy is.
But to take your metaphor from your book, The Gardens of Democracy and the ecosystem idea, it seems to me that the 1% or the wealthy or the plutocrats, whatever you want to call them, who clearly dominate our economy, they are dominating this election cycle through super PACs. And there's no question that they have greater access, which is a polite way of saying that they have an awful lot of influence on Capitol Hill. I think all of that is reasonable, right? So, but do they see themselves separate and apart from the broader ecosystem? I mean, at a certain point, you ask a moral question: is it acceptable to step over homeless people in order to get into a five-star restaurant? I mean, if we're going to, you're saying that what's looming out there is a revolution. Why not make more of a social contract? Why not make this country more of the egalitarian country that we all believe it is?
I mean, well, because first of all, I think there are two ways to argue this point. You can argue about inequality in two ways. The first way you can argue about it is morally. You can make a moral argument that inequality is unfair, that it compounds advantages and disadvantages, or as my young daughter likes to say, it's mean, right? Inequality is mean. It's mean to step over a homeless person to walk into a five-star restaurant. And I think it's a very, very powerful argument. There's another argument to be made, which is that inequality is extraordinary. It is terrible for business. That in fact, it doesn't serve anyone's medium and long-term self-interest. Because an economy where everybody has lots and lots of money to spend is an economy that is booming, that is great for the middle class and working class, and has enormous opportunities for capitalists too. Both of those arguments need to be deployed. I do think that there are some people who simply don't care about anyone but themselves, and aren't going to be moved by either the moral argument or the economic argument, because it requires you to take less than a 10-minute view down the road. But I think there are many, many capitalists many people who have bought this existing economic orthodoxy, who are people of high moral character, and who deeply care about the country, and who will, when confronted with this new way of thinking about how the economy works, will begin to change their minds. I can certainly tell you that in my small circle of capitalists, my arguments are persuading people, entrepreneurs, who started out being incredibly angry and offended by my arguments over the last year or two, have completely come around and who now completely agree with me that we have been thinking about this in the wrong way. And because they take a long view, that they're quite willing to admit that if their tax rates went up and we invested more in the middle class, their customers, that not only would it be morally righteous, but that capitalism and capitalists would be better off.
So Nick Hanar, again, Seattle-based serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, author, and activist with a knack for identifying and building transformative business models. In 1995, he became the first non-family investor in Amazon.com, where he served as a board advisor until January of 2000. During the same time period, he founded and served as CEO of A Quantitative Inc., and a short time later founded Gear.com. A Quantitative was acquired by Microsoft for $6.4 billion, the largest acquisition in Microsoft's history, and Gear.com merged with Overstock.com in 2001. And his latest book is The Gardens of Democracy. So do you think that I know that's an unscientific survey, but do you think that there is a change of heart amongst the wealthiest Americans? I mean, Pete Peterson just got through with a conference in New York, and he's a deficit hawk that's been investing quite a lot of money. He's made an awful lot of money, but he's been, quite obsessed about deficits. And he's a big supporter of the Ryan budget, and Ryan, of course, and Boehner were both there along with Bill Clinton at the conference. And the long and the short of it is, what they're really telling us is, at least the Ryans and Petersons of this world, is that the middle class and the working people in this country have had it too good. Social Security and Medicare are just too profligate, and the deficit is the greatest problem we have, and the only way to rein that in is for the middle class and working Americans to take a hit. No mention of the people that you know that pay 15% taxes, none whatsoever.
Yeah, and I think I wasn't at that conference. I do not know what those people said. But if it is what they said, I think it's absolutely ludicrous. Now, I think Social Security is a minor problem. I do think that it's slightly out of balance. But if you move the retirement age by a year or two, it comes into balance very easily. If you up the age at which, dollar exemption a little tiny bit, it comes into balance. Social Security, getting Social Security to be viable is a very easy problem. Medical costs are another thing entirely, and Medicare is eating the budget. And unless and until we are ready to reform our healthcare system and find ways to deliver equal or better healthcare to citizens for much less money, that is going to be a continuing problem. By the way, the United States spends someplace between 33% and 50% more per citizen per year on healthcare than every other industrialized nation chooses not to cover 20% of our citizens, and gets worse results. The healthcare problem is a resolvable problem, but we have to have the political will to fix it.
Well, just in closing, the idea that you've put across and that came out of the TED speech that you gave, and now, of course, it's become quite viral, both the text and the video, and we're very grateful to you that we're able to offer up your book here in our fund drive, The Guards of Democracy. Just a quote from your speech, though, to give our audience an idea of the simple logic of what you're saying. You're saying that another reason why this idea of the billionaires' trickle-down theories are so wrong-headed is that there can never be enough super-rich people to power a great economy. Somebody like me makes hundreds of thousands times as much as the median American, but I don't buy hundreds or thousands of times as much stuff. My family owns 3 cars, not 3,000.
Right. You know, that's the problem, is that if all the wealth is concentrated tippy-top, you aren't going to be able to buy very many cars or very many clothes, or you're not going to go out to very many restaurants, right? Because there is a very, very obvious upper limit to the number of pairs of jeans I can buy and the number of cars I need.
Sure. As Bill Gates' father said, you can't sail two yachts at the same time.
You cannot sail two yachts at the same time. And you can't drive two cars to work at the same time. We definitely... And again, speaking somewhat selfishly, as a person who runs and owns businesses, I want a country where everyone can afford to buy the stuff that I make, not just the top 1%. There's no market in the top 1%.
Right.
You just can't sell enough stuff there.
So tell us why we should get your book. I mean, you're probably better at pitching your book than I am.
Because the thesis of Guardians of Democracy is that when you understand human social systems, like economies, like political systems, in this new way, as complex, adaptive, and ecosystemic, and not in the old way, which is linear, closed, and mechanistic, you come to completely different conclusions about how you should organize a society. And that new perspective is like scales falling from your eyes. Again, the reason that I can make these persuasive arguments about job creators is because I've immersed myself in understanding these systems in this way. And I think that the arguments we make in Guardians of Democracy are a genuinely new way of thinking about the problems we face as a society and the political challenges that we have. And I think that the ideas and the narrative is a powerful new way to help us unmess the current mess that we're in.
Well, Nicholas Hanauer, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your book, The Guardians of Democracy.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I was just speaking then with Nicholas Hanauer, who's a Seattle-based serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, author, and activist with a knack for identifying and building transformative business models. In 1995, Hanauer became the first non-family investor in Amazon.com, where he served as a board advisor until January of 2000. During the same time period, he founded and served as CEO of A Quantitative Inc., and a short time later founded Gear.com. A Quantitative was acquired by Microsoft in August of 2007 for $6.4 billion, the largest acquisition in Microsoft's history, and Gear.com merged with Overstock.com in 2001. His latest book is The Gardens of Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in a minute.